Hello, everybody. This is Dr. Diana Wiley, and I'm your host of Love, Lust, and Laughter. And my guest is medical journalist Michael Castleman. And he has answered more than 12,000 sex questions throughout his career, including on his website, greatsexguidance.com, and through All About Sex blog on Psychology Today, and he used to be on Playboy's Advisor. So 12,000 sex questions is a lot. He has a quote from his last book. We're going to talk about his book soon to be published, but his last book, Great Sex, and I just love it, and it's so appropriate for today. Sex becomes less like the 4th of July and more like Thanksgiving. So welcome to this program again, Michael Castleman. I'm so glad you're here.
I'm delighted to be on, Diana. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. So, Thanksgiving's going to be a little different this year. And let's talk about that, and then I want to get into your new book, Sizzling Sex, for a Lifetime. And but how come it's going to be a little different this year? I mean, I know and you know, but let's share with our listeners.
Well, it's going to be a lot smaller groups.
We're
having three people, my wife, myself, and my daughter, which is down from an average of, in previous years, we've had, 9 to 12 people. We're having three this year. And I think most Americans are going to observe COVID precautions and have fewer people. Dr. Fauci is having very few people at his house. So that creates tensions and it also creates some opportunities. And so we need to manage our stress and try and focus on the opportunities that have come up.
Yes, it's very true that so many couples and people have recalibrated their holiday plans because they really want to keep themselves and their loved ones safe in the midst of all this uncertainty. So I think that a lot of people need to be reminded, although many people apparently aren't paying attention to this because we're seeing lots of people heading for the airports, but we're spending time apart this year so that we can be together next year. It's hard for a lot of people, and we're just on the verge of having vaccines distributed. But we've just got to be careful these last few months of winter. No question about it. And I like that you said, we have tensions, but we also have some opportunities. And, talk a little bit about some of the silver linings that some people may discover.
Well, this should be the moment when I plug your book, Love in the Time of Corona, where you, eloquently state many of the ways that people can use the extenuating circumstances of today to inject new life and vitality into their relationships and their love lives. For me, when people talk to me, ask me about COVID stress, I basically promote massage, massage, neck massage, foot massage, hand massage, massage of the whole body. And because massage is a unique touch, is an essential nutrient delivered through the skin. And massage is the basis of all lovemaking. When people say sex, most people flash on intercourse. But intercourse is just one, is often the culmination of a lovemaking process that should go on for 20 or 30 minutes that is primarily kissing and cuddling and hugging and mutual whole body massage, which releases tension and piques erotic excitement and helps fill in the blanks that are in people's lives now. The, you know, people can't pursue a lot of their passions because of COVID, but they can literally get more in touch with the person they love if they have a partner. And if not, self-massage is also very effective. And of course, self-sexing is the basis of all sexuality. So really, sex is less about intercourse than it is about mutual touch. And I think that this is a moment when people can just hug and touch each other and give massages and see that as an opportunity in at the end of 2020.
I couldn't agree with you more, and thank you for plugging my book. And you did that on your Psychology Today blog, and you told me that it had, what, 5,000 views. Thank you again for that. It was really a very nice blog post. And Michael Castleman, you have so much to say that is really, really useful. You've been in the business for about 40 years, and you did the Playboy Advisors column in the 90s. So, and more than 12,000 sex questions, that's a lot.
A lot. Yeah, I answer, for the last, 30 years or so, I've answered 1 to 2 sex questions a day.
And, a day.
And I still sometimes get new ones. You know, many are routine, of course, as in any business. I mean, you call your plumber for a plugged-up toilet, he's seen it before. And the same thing with a lot of sex questions. A lot of people just need basic information. But, you know, as times change, people's interests change, their focuses change, and sexuality evolves. It doesn't change drastically, but it does evolve, particularly in our in the 21st century, as gender has become a real cutting-edge issue. It has raised a lot of new questions. So I still get some new ones, and I love answering sex questions because they bring people pleasure and happiness. I mean, I was a medical journalist. I've been a medical journalist for almost 50 years. And, you know, you write an article about 6 ways to deal with diabetes, you don't get any thank you notes. You answer people sex questions, and not always, but a fair amount of time, people say, oh, thank you, I appreciate that. And it's really the thank you notes that have kept me excited about being involved in this field.
I couldn't agree with you more. I mean, your experience is magnitudes more than mine, but just with my first little book, Love in the Time of Corona, I've already had a lot of thank yous for the book, and I have to admit some of them come through the clients that I'm also seeing and spending an hour with, usually once every 2 weeks, but through Zoom. But I stay in this field as a marriage and family therapist and as a board-certified sex therapist because I genuinely want to help people, and it is so satisfying when people have learn how to have better sex and more satisfying sex, and sex that is more about whole body caressing and that sort of thing. That's what keeps me in. It's just thrilling when people tell me about the transformations they've seen in their relationships and in themselves. And your books really, I've recommended your books, especially, well, Sizzling Sex is now available for pre-order. We're going to get to that in a minute. But just recently, I have a 63-year-old man who was using a lot of pornography and having premature ejaculation, and I recommended Great Sex, A Man's Guide to the Secret Principles of Total Body Sex. Your last book, It was your last book, wasn't it? Did you work on it in there that I missed?
Yeah, 2004. Yeah, that came out 16 years ago.
Yes, but it's still very relevant, extremely. And, yes, to hear from people that it's helped their lives so much, doesn't that make a difference?
Yeah, it does to me. And the great thing about sex questions and most sex problems is that if people have reasonably decent relationships, and then on top of that they have sexual issues, the sexual issues almost always get better. They may not be 100% cured, but in the context of a reasonably functional relationship, all sexual issues can, if not get completely resolved, they get better. I mean, now, some couples have horrendous relationship issues that kill their sexual interest in each other and their sexual enjoyment, and that's what marriage and family therapists are for. But for your average person who is in a decent relationship and they have sex questions that are plaguing them, answering those questions, sex gets better, and it often gets better very quickly, which is the other, which is another great thing about being in the sex counseling business, is that you get fairly rapid results, which I really like, and the people who ask the questions like that too.
Exactly, and of course you're such an excellent writer. The Library Journal calls you one of the nation's top health writers. And, I mean, you write so clearly, you communicate so well, and you have just cutting-edge information, as well as going back, well, maybe this is a good segue, because we'll flip around, we'll go from one to the other, but to your book that is available now on pre-order. And this, you have in Sizzling Sex for Life, you have taken 2,500 studies published over the last 70 years, and you've used this as source material. I've never seen another sex guide with that many scientific studies that are used as examples.
Well, thank you.
I mean, that's very impressive. That must have taken lots and lots of time.
Well, like I said, I've been writing about sex for almost 50 years, and I wrote Sizzling Sex took 3 years to write. And it really is the most comprehensive sexuality guide ever attempted. If you know, there's zillions of sex books out there, and most of them are narrow cast. You know, sex for how to talk to your kids about sex, sex and teenagers, women and sex. You know, sex for older people, all that kind of stuff. All those books are can be very valuable, and friends of mine have written a lot of them. But I started feeling about 5 years ago that there was a hole and there was a gap in the literature, because no one had ever really looked at sexual issues from cradle to grave, from the sexual implications of circumcision all the way through life to the growing phenomenon of sex in nursing homes and everything in between, and not just and the good, the bad, and the ugly. I mean, sex can bring tremendous pleasure, but there are also some very thorny downsides to sex. I mean, child sex abuse, sexual assault. Sex is a many splendored thing and often not so great. So Sizzling Sex, my new book, my forthcoming book that will be available in January, looks at all of them. And tries to take a comprehensive look at all common sexual issues, because so much of how you are as an adult sexually depends in part on how you were as a child and how your parents talked to you about sex or didn't. And that's what I've been trying to get at with Sizzling Sex for Life, is a one book between two covers, a whole sexuality library for the general reading public.
This is much needed, and I can envision that there are going to be a lot of sex educators in schools and in high schools and universities that will want your book, that will use it as a real guide. And also so many couples, and yes, so many populations are addressed in your book, which, by the way, is available for pre-order now. And there's so much good couples information that I can envision that any of you listening out there, and if you're fortunate enough to be in a relationship, go ahead and pre-order Michael Castleman's book, Sizzling Sex for Life. You can pre-order it. Tell us how they can do that, Michael.
Well, just go to Amazon.com and search Sizzling Sex for Life. It comes right up, and you can pre-order. And that would be wonderful if people did that.
Yeah, and also they should visit your great website, greatsexguidance.com. I'll put all of this in my show notes. And I of course, was very complimented when you, under your Mike's Picks, you included this program, which you've been on before, Love, Lust, and Laughter. And thank you. Thank you for that. And Mike's Picks. Appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Yes. We've known each other a long time. I so appreciate you, and I'm grateful for you. One of the things that you address in Sizzling Sex is the couple sex problems, and that sort of encompasses your quote, which I opened the show with, sex becomes less like 4th of July and more like Thanksgiving. That's about desire differences, which is the most common presenting problem that I get, that most sex therapists get, and you've written about that, of course, Michael.
Yeah.
Desire differences.
Desire differences is the number one problem of long-term couples, and it's not anything. It's not a failing of the couple at all. It is virtually inevitable. I mean, everyone. There's only one sexual generalization that is universally true, and that is that everyone is sexually unique. Our sexuality is as individual as our fingerprints, our taste in food and clothing, travel. It's very highly individual. And when you take two individuals with uniquely individual sexual tastes and interests, and you put them together, you are inevitably going to have differences of opinion about how sex should proceed, when, where, and how often. So resolving desire differences is not just a sex problem for couples. It is one of the central tasks of establishing and maintaining a long-term relationship that's a sexual relationship, as most marriages are. Not all. There are some marriages that are mutually consensually sexless, but they are a very small minority. Most people get married, they think they're going to have regular sex. And that's when the trouble starts, because people bring their own individual proclivities to the process, and conflict is almost inevitable, and which is why desire differences are the number one reason why people consult sex therapists. And fortunately, over the decades, many brilliant sex therapists have developed a program that helps people deal with desire differences and overcome them. And it's not there's no magic to it. It's really fairly simple. I have a chapter in my book called How Sex Therapists Recommend Overcoming Desire Differences. And really, it has to do with, number one, getting past the notion that that this is a power issue. I want to have sex and you don't. And who has the power and who controls the sex in your relationship? You have to get past that to the point of saying, look, we both have needs, we both have desires. Is there some way we can accommodate each other in relative harmony and proceed to live our lives? And when couples decide on a sexual frequency and then negotiate scheduled sex dates, their lives become much improved very quickly. You know, there's a myth that that sex happens spontaneously when people are in the mood. Well, that is a very apt description of what happens when people fall in love. They have sex spontaneously a lot, and they're always in the mood. But after 6 months or so, one or both of them have declining sense of sexual urgency, and that's when desire differences develop and start driving people crazy. And so sex therapists almost universally recommend that couples in long-term relationships schedule their sex in advance, which takes tremendous burden off of both people. And it also helps with solo sexing. Some people object when the other person is involved in self-sexing that may interfere with partner sex. Well, if you're scheduling your partner sex, you can enjoy your solo sex at other times.
Guilt-free.
Right.
Yes. And I have found that, for example, a couple and the woman has low desire, although about 40% of the time it's the man with the lower desire. That's a stereotype that is I've noticed is not true in my practice. But say the woman has low sex desire and she just dreads going off to the bedroom. So she stops being affectionate. And you write about this. I do too. She stops being affectionate because she fears that it's going to be a signal to her partner that she's indeed interested in having sex. So there's all this anxiety, and of course the relationship suffers because they're not being affectionate, they're not being demonstrative with each other. And so, but if sex is on the calendar and they do two things, slow down, I've said those two words a lot over the 35 years I've been doing this work, slow down, and if it's on the calendar, she said, all right, you know, I don't have to, I can be affectionate, we can do all of these fun things together, and I know that we're going to have at least an hour together Saturday night after maybe a takeout dinner that we've enjoyed at home and setting the scene. But it takes so much of her anticipatory anxiety away if it's on the calendar. It is such a myth. We both write about this, to think that sex needs to be spontaneous for it to be really good. And that's just a total myth, because it takes away the intentions. If we're intentional about sex, it's apt to be better sex, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. And the return of non-sexual affection, people who are plagued by desire difference, you know, the one with the higher desire is always touching the other person, hoping that that they can, you know, engineer them into bed. The lower desire person is shunning all non-sexual affection for fear of sending the wrong message. And when they schedule their sex, then all of a sudden, marvelous non-sexual affection returns to the relationship. Kissing, cuddling, particularly people almost always say, oh yeah, now we cuddle when we're watching TV.
Yes.
And in the time of Corona now, I mean, people are watching a lot more TV and streaming Netflix and whatnot, and so it's really nice to be able to feel like you can nuzzle up to your honey without sending the wrong message or being misinterpreted. And non-sexual affection is so important in the day-to-day processing of a relationship that it's really one of the wonderful gifts of scheduling sex is that the couple enjoys a wonderful return to non-sexual affection.
I say that, you know, you have your date night at home and so many people binge on TV. I say, no, binge on each other. Binge on each other. It's such a, it creates so much, so much goodwill. You write about that too. It creates goodwill in the relationship. And
yeah.
Don't we need that?
Yeah, we do. And this is where I was mentioned earlier about massaging, mutual massage.
Yes.
Even you know, obviously sex is based on massage, but outside of the bedroom, non-sexual, affectionate massage, shoulder rubs, and people are under a lot of tension these days. And so, and people put that tension in various places, their necks, their shoulders, their backs. It can be a wonderful gift to a partner to just, for 5 minutes, give them a little neck and shoulder massage. It means the world. And in a situation where you know that your scheduled sex is tomorrow night or the day after tomorrow, there are no implications of the shoulder massage this evening.
Yeah, that's right. It can just be for the sake of rubbing my partner's neck and shoulders to help them feel more relaxed. And then it's
right.
Often it's reciprocated.
A new pattern gets established in the relationship instead of the pattern of one person constantly demanding sex and the other feeling besieged and beleaguered, then you have two people who enjoy hugging each other. Isn't that more pleasant? Isn't that the way you want to live? I mean, and that's why negotiating desire differences and coming to a mutual accommodation can really make a tremendous improvement in the quality of relationship and the quality of life.
It does make a difference. I've seen it. And I've had some couples say the low desire woman, well, all right, so we have sex scheduled like Sunday night. And what if we get to Sunday night and I don't feel well, or I just don't feel like it. I've been working up to it. I've been trying to anticipate all of this, but I really don't feel like it. You write that you need to give a rain check with every intention to follow through the next time. Can you just expand on that a little bit, the rain check idea, if a person really isn't feeling like the date night and the scheduled sex?
Well, you know, in life things happen and unanticipated events unfold, and sometimes your best laid plans just don't quite work out. And I think that couples, once the temperature has been reduced from heated arguments about sexual frequency to a mutual accommodation with scheduled sex, if one person wants to say, well, how about I'm not feeling quite right today, can we do it tomorrow or the next day? That's fine. But the person who is asking for rescheduling can't just keep doing that and putting sex off forever. There has to be good faith at the basis of the agreement that both people are committed to being lovers together and following through on their commitment. But, you know, I mean, life is unpredictable and things happen. So I advocate, and all sex therapists say that you have to be, you know, a little easygoing with your partner. And when people are accommodating, that also builds good faith and strengthens the relationship, and people feel like they're being listened to and understood. which is very important in the emotional health of intimate relationships.
Being listened to and understood, that is so key. So many people do not listen very well. They don't do the act of listening. And as a sex therapist, so often I have to do psychotherapy before I can do sex therapy. And the psychotherapy involves, well, let's really break down how you communicate and how you don't. And what are some of the roadblocks? And what are some of the problems? Because I just saw a couple, whenever I say saw these days, it's always on Zoom, just yesterday, and he said, this was our second session, and he said, you know, he grew up in a family where nobody, well, his wife too, but nobody talked about sex, very strict Catholics, and he was, there was shame around it, and all, you know, I've heard these stories before, but he said to me, in our first session, I was really comfortable with you, Dr. Diana, and because you're so, you model, he didn't use that word, but you model ease with sexual communication. And he said, now I'm even more comfortable. And, of course, I give them exercises that they can do, homework exercises that they can do to facilitate sexual communication. But that's a huge problem for so many couples. They don't have the words. They just don't know how to get started. And they've been silent about what they need and want. And so they stop having sex. The couple that I'm just mentioning, they have not had sex for 2 years. And now they're getting back on track.
Yeah.
But, yeah.
Yeah, well, in my book, Sizzling Sex, there's a chapter called Sexual Coaching Made Easy, where it talks, you know, every sex educator says that communication is key to good sex. And if I had a nickel for every time some sex person said communication is important, I'd be a wealthy man. I'd be Bill Gates.
Yeah, that's right.
But problem is that in a lot of sex education, they don't tell you what to say.
That's right.
And so I have this chapter called Sexual Coaching Made Easy, where in very few words, you can clearly, kindly, lovingly state what you like and don't like, and in a way that partners generally can absorb. Because sexual coaching is not something, it's not one and done. It's not like you coach each other on your honeymoon and then you never have to do it again. I mean, people are always changing. Sex changes with age, and people's tastes change as they get older. And you have to coach your partner now that you're 40, now that you're 50, now that you're 60. People get injured and have to accommodate the injury, and while still making love. People get ill. People, all kinds of changes happen that require, that involve slight adjustments in lovemaking. And it's important to know how to ask for what you need and to ask another person, ask your lover, if what you're doing is okay. I think that, you know, a lot of this is covered. When people visit sex therapists, a lot of that is covered in the sessions. But the problem is there are only a few thousand sex therapists in the United States, a nation of 320 million people. And a lot of people can't afford sex therapy. So in my book, I try to bring a public health approach to people who aren't going to go to sex therapy and but want some of the wisdom of 75 years of sex therapy distilled for them in a way that they can use. And that's what I've tried to do in Sizzling Sex for Life.
And I did see a preview copy and gave a blurb for your book, and it is a book that everybody should have in their library. Kind of an overview of it, Michael Castleman. So you include school sex education and pornography. And let's do a little. I'm going to break this down in terms of what you cover, but talk a little bit about the school sex education, and then let's go to pornography because that's a real hot topic. But school sex education.
I spent several years doing school sex education, and I thought I was making an impression. But the best research, and there's now many, many studies showing the same result, so it's a credible finding, is that school sex education doesn't matter very much to how young people behave sexually. Yes, if it's abstinence-only sex education, pregnancy goes up, and if it's comprehensive, if you teach kids about condoms and the other methods, pregnancy goes down a little bit, but not very much. Well, you know what makes the biggest difference? The only thing that really makes a big difference in how young people manage their sexuality is when their parents talk to them about it. Young people look to their parents for around issues that involve values, and sexuality is a very value-laden subject. And when I first came across this research, I had two teenage kids, and I couldn't believe it. How can parents make a difference? My kids didn't seem to pay attention to me at all. And so I thought, this can't be true. But in fact, many, many studies have shown the same finding. And now that my children are adults and we talk about it in retrospect, they say, oh, yeah, we appreciated the fact that you would talk to us about sex. A lot of our friends' parents wouldn't. So if you are a parent of young kids or teens and they seem to tune you out about sex, don't believe it. They're actually sponges who are soaking it all up. They're just not letting you know. And I'm all for sex education in school. I'm for sex education in colleges. I wish there were billboards proclaiming sex education concepts. But the thing that makes the biggest difference consistently is when parents talk about sex. And the problem is that parents become tongue-tied. It's very hard for kids to see their parents as sexual people, and it's hard for parents to see their kids as sexual people. And that's why I have a chapter in my book, one on how to talk to toddlers and preschoolers about sex, and then another one about how to talk to your teens about sex. And then finally, there's a chapter that talks about young adult hookups and how parents are often very paranoid about them. They think that their kids are out, you know, screwing somebody new every night, which is simply not true. Those three chapters in Sizzling Sex for Life try to take an overview of what sexual communication between parents and kids is like from the time that they're toddlers to the time that they're about 25. And I hope that those chapters help people with an area of parenting that often a lot of people need help with, because so many people complain, oh, my parents never said word one to me about sex. Well, let's stop that. Let's start talking about it in the family, because that's where it counts.
Because silence is a message, too. And I remember early in my career taking a course from Dr. Sol Gordon, and I know you know about him. And
yeah,
he encouraged, he was a wonderful man. I thought he was funny, he was informed, but he talked about looking for teachable moments with your child, and that sex education doesn't just start at age 12 when you sit your kid down, if that happens at all, but to look for teachable moments and to actually rehearse some possible events with your teenage girl who may be getting pressured by a teenage boy in her class. And I remember one of the lines that he suggested that the teenage girl might say to her prospective boyfriend, or her boyfriend, if you really loved me, you wouldn't put this kind of pressure on me to have, you know, full intercourse and that sort of thing. So he was such a good sex educator. And early on in my career, I also talked to some PTAs about talking to your kids about sex. I was very lucky because my parents did talk to us about sex. And the first big talk was when I was in fifth grade. My sister was in fourth grade, and we were driving from San Francisco to Los Angeles, where we lived at the time in Los Angeles. But all the way from Santa Barbara to L.A. is when my father brought it up, and then my mother came in. And I was, who thought I'd become a sex therapist one day? But when he talked about the penis going in the vagina and the whole conception process, I was just shocked. I was shocked.
Yeah.
And I remember my mother turning around and saying, "Diana, don't keep looking out the window. There's nothing to be embarrassed about. Sex is a beautiful thing." The caveat, this was in the 50s, when you're married, it's a beautiful thing that you have to look forward to. Nothing to be embarrassed about. Wasn't I lucky to have parents like that?
Right, you were. And the phenomenon of people pressuring, young people pressuring each other for more sex, obviously this is almost a rite of passage. And sometimes it's boys pressuring girls, and sometimes it's the other way around, that the girl is pressuring the boy. And that's why I have a chapter in Sizzling Sex for Life. I have a chapter called The Virgin's Guide to Happily Losing It that talks about how to negotiate your way up the sexual ladder, how to see yourself where you are on the ladder of sexual escalation, and how to gauge your own comfort with the rung you're on, and how you feel about taking the next step, and how to talk about that with a partner so that your first time of going all the way, as it were, will be happier than many, many people's are. I mean, if you ask people about their first time, once in a blue moon, somebody says it was magical, but overwhelmingly, people said, "Well, I don't know. It was sort of fraught. It was weird," and it often happens when young people are drunk and they don't even hardly know what's going on. So that chapter, "The Virgin's Guide to Happily Losing It," is really one of my favorites in the book, because it can come in real handy for teenage folks and for their parents who are trying to counsel them about how to negotiate erotic escalation.
Yes, and that reminds me of something else. In sex ed courses, rarely is pleasure discussed.
Almost never.
Yeah. Almost
never. We don't have, in the United States, we do not have sex education. What we have is dangers of sex education. We only talk about the problems. We only talk about the infections and pregnancy. That's so-called comprehensive sex education. It's only comprehensive about contraceptions and the downsides of sex. It never mentions pleasure, and that's really... that is really a failure of the education system, because the way to sell sex is to sell it as pleasure. If you do sex right, if you're sexually responsible, you have more pleasure. You don't just prevent pregnancy and gonorrhea. You have more fun in bed, and that's what young people want. And so I think that we should sell sex education as a way to enhance pleasure. But, of course, boards of education just won't go for that. All they'll go for is dangers of sex. And so that's what we've got, if we have that even.
I'm very proud of the state that I now live in, Washington State. I've lived here for the last 12 years. And And so on Election Day, we had a Proposition 90, which passed, and it's all about mandatory sex education in the public schools.
Yeah.
Now,
Texas
parents can write a letter and get their kid out of it, but we need more states to have good, thorough sex education that does also talk about pleasure.
Yeah, well, I don't think they're going to talk about pleasure, but yes, it's good that more states are getting away from abstinence only, which is a total failure.
Total failure.
But I myself think that if school districts really wanted to do a good job with sex education, they would sponsor evening classes for parents called How to Talk to Your Kids About Sex.
Yes,
because it's
that's
the parents
right.
talking about it that is the real education here, not the schools. And it's the parents who need to be educated. And so I think it's the perfect night school for parents. I think would be a tremendous boon to sexual happiness in America.
I agree with that. And even if a parent is just too embarrassed to talk about it, they can find a really good sex education book that is targeted for the age range that their kid is in, and say, look, I'm a little uncomfortable discussing sexual matters, but I want you to read this book, and if you have questions, I want to be able to answer them. Come to me, and if I don't know the answers, I'm going to look them up. But I want us to have a discussion about this, because when I was growing up, my parents were totally silent on the subject, and there was no benefit to that whatsoever to me personally or to my developmental life.
Yeah. Yeah, well, let's hope.
And a good segue into pornography is that the sad thing is that so many boys in particular get their sex education by viewing porn. And this has been available since the early 2000s, right? Because they can see porn on their phones. And
well,
so they're getting their sex education from porn, and I know you have a lot to say about that.
Yeah, I have 7 chapters in Sizzling Sexual
yes.
Life about pornography, and yes, men, myself included, all young men get a great deal of their sex education from porn, the problem is that porn is really like the chase scenes in action movies. It's exciting and it's fun to watch, but it's not the way to drive. And everyone knows
yeah.
it's not the way to drive because you have to take driver's ed to get a driver's license. And so once you have a driver's license and you know how you're supposed to drive, you can watch action movies with chase scenes and enormous pile-ups of cars and realize that it's just a fantasy. The problem is that porn is a fantasy of sex. It's a fantasy of super abundant sex with no responsibility. And that's a fun fantasy, particularly for men, but it's not the way to make love. And so one of the chapters in my book, Sizzling Sex for Life, is called The Main Problem with Pornography is That It Teaches Sex All Wrong. And I go through about 40 different ways that porn misleads men and women about themselves, their bodies, and the other gender's body and sexuality. So I have nothing against people watching pornography, as long as they understand that it's a fantasy, that it should be used to pique interest and desire and get you turned on, but it's not the way to make love. In fact, the best way to make love is to do the opposite of what you see in porn. So, for example, pornography is almost 95% genital and about 5% kissing and hugging. Well, what you want is the opposite of that. You want it mostly kissing and hugging and mutual massage, especially for the first 20 minutes or so. And then after that, you can focus on the genitals. But porn doesn't do that. It's all genital all the time. And that is a real problem. So, but like I said, I have nothing against people watching pornography, as long as they understand that it's a cartoon. It makes about as much sense as, you know, Wile E. Coyote running off a cliff and then realizing he's in midair and turning around and running back to terra firma. It's funny when you watch that in a cartoon, but let's not run off cliffs, okay?
Let's not. And I know you're a big advocate for tossing the porn at least occasionally and picking up the bottle of massage oil. And but many couples, and I've recommended, particularly, don't we all miss, you know, I was good friends with Candida Royale. She died of ovarian cancer, as you know, and I've mentioned this on the show before. She was on this show about 7-8 years ago. I loved her, and she was so intelligent, but she was the first female director, producer, writer focusing on couples and female pleasure and relationships. And she started in 1984. She took a big chance, because it was male porn before all of that. And I have had many couples watch porn together. Now, sometimes they go to Erica Lust. I think she puts out some good explicit films for couples to watch together. And we all can learn visually, but it's when porn is a secret and done usually by the male exclusively, that's when it creates a problem, many problems in the couple's relationship, especially if the female partner discovers it. And she feels, I have a couple that's going through this right now. She feels so betrayed, and then she's all nervous, and I don't have a body like that the actresses have, and I don't have the enthusiasm that the actresses have, and all of this. So it becomes... It becomes a real conundrum for a lot of couples.
Yeah, well, I wish that everyone lighten up about that a little bit. I mean, for example, my wife loves professional basketball, and we watch a lot of professional basketball on TV. And every single professional basketball player in the National Basketball Association is bigger than I am, taller than I am, more athletic than I am, got a better body than I've got. But I don't feel threatened by that. I mean, it's the fact that my wife and I both admire the unbelievable athleticism of professional basketball players. We understand that they are very different from us. And they mm-hmm. they're not part of our lives. Our lives are wrapped up in each other. And if women who feel threatened by the bodies in pornography really haven't seen very much porn, because today, I mean, any kind of body you can imagine is depicted in porn. I mean, there's pornography with 75-year-old people. There's pornography with anorexic people, obese people. I mean, amputees. Any kind of body you can possibly imagine. There's porn with those people. And so it's not really the bodies that are that people are admiring. It is the fact of watching people be sexual, no matter who they are, and no matter how they're being sexual. And it's okay to have sexual fantasies. I you know, in fantasy, everything is permitted and nothing is wrong. So if you want to have fantasies of an orgy, go right ahead. But if you want to have you and your lover participate in an orgy, well, that's going to take a lot of negotiation, and it just might not happen.
Yes, yes, exactly. And then to do one step down from an orgy, and you write about this in your book too, that the consensual non-monogamy is more popular than a lot of people believe. But that's
oh, yeah.
a whole show that I hope I can do with you in January after your book is formally out. Because it's consensual non-monogamy is working for more and more people, but my goodness, so you use the word negotiation. So much negotiation is needed because there, and really so much of life is about negotiation, but especially if you're going to have a more open sexual relationship and you're married or in a committed relationship, you've got to talk about it and be very practical about the rules that you have before you get together with somebody else. And even then, it can be a problem or it can be fun. But it a lot depends on the strength of the relationship, the maturity of the couple, and on and on and on.
Yeah, and often, about the consensual non-monogamy is... happens everywhere in the United States. There are sex clubs and swing clubs in every state of the union, and they're in urban areas, suburbs, in rural areas. But for most people, they're an occasional spice. You know, there are some people who are very serious about polyamory or swinging. But for the large majority of people who try consensual non-monogamy, it's like, you know, an occasional thing that you do on vacation or you do once a year on your anniversary or something like that. And I have a chapter in my in Sizzling Sex for Life that is called The Curious Couple's Guide to Consensual Non-Monogamy, where I talk about the various different clear ground rules for the couple who's doing it, so that no one feels left out and no one feels ignored and no one feels pressured to be sexual in ways they want. And fortunately, all of the sex clubs and swing clubs that I'm aware of, there's never any pressure to be sexual. In fact, there's explicit rules on the walls saying no means no, and if anyone's reluctant, don't push it. But as you said, consensual non-monogamy is something that is coming more and more visible in America, and it's not that people are necessarily more consensually non-monogamous than they used to be. It's just that it's a lot more visible than it was, say, 30 or 40 years ago. And now we have sex clubs and swing clubs everywhere. In fact, your listeners could put in sex club or swing club or BDSM club and any locale where they are and search that on Google, and you might be surprised what you find.
I agree with you, absolutely. And I've seen couples who, over the years, who want to experiment with this. And so we always talk about the rules that are necessary in the communication. And what I've seen happen several times is that the wife was a bit pressured to do it. And finally she said, okay, I'm going to go to the swing club with you. And the rules are all there, and no means no, and especially from a woman. I mean, from a man, too, but the woman is highlighted. The outcome is I've found many times, is the woman gets a lot of attention from other men, and the man doesn't get as much attention, and he's disappointed.
Right.
And
right,
she likes it.
Yep, that's what happens often.
All right, Michael, I hear the music. We got to stop, but I'll have you back in the new year. And
well, thank you for having me on, Diane. I really appreciate it, and I wish you a happy Thanksgiving and a happy new year.
And I wish you the same, too. And to everyone out there, happy Thanksgiving, and do be grateful. Do be grateful. Count your blessings. Thank you, everybody. Bye-bye.
Love it. Happy feet, da da da, happy feet.